The high life, fast cars, superstardom. Get a taste of the action when you join Sky with any TV bundle from £20 a month. Because the big time is back in US hit Ballers, exclusively on Sky Atlantic. And you'll also get a brand new free 32-inch LG TV. But you'll have to be fast. Offer ends August 18th. Search Sky Bundles. Sky. Believe in better.
Direct debit, subject to status. Upfront £10 standard setup. Minimum contract and further terms apply.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, welcome to Let's Talk Tribe. This is your host, Jason Lucart. It's Thursday night. The Indians, I thought they'd be done by now. The game's running long. They're in the ninth inning. Chris Perez is making things interesting. But hopefully in the next pitch or two, I'll be able to report a win, which, of course, you'll already know about before you hear this. It's been a good week for the Indians since last we talked. Last week, I talked to Ryan, who was going to the game, the series opener against Houston, and the Indians went on to sweep the Astros in four games and then won a couple games against the White Sox. So they've won six in a row. A couple of things about the White Sox series, finishing their season series against the White Sox with 14 straight wins, which is the Indians' third longest winning streak against any team in franchise history, the record being 17 in a row against the 54 Orioles. And they went 17-2 against the White Sox this year, which is their most wins against any team since the expansion era started in 1961, which is, of course, significant because they don't play teams as often as they did anymore. So one of the most dominant performances they've ever had against any team, and a nice way to keep this part of the season going. Chris Perez just gave up a home run, which is tremendous. I love him. The lead is now down to one. And I don't know if I can handle doing the podcast and checking on the game because I'm going to lose it if he goes on to blow this. So I'll report back to you after I talk with this week's guest, who is a writer for ESPN and one heck of a guy. My guest this week is Dan Zimborski. Dan, how you doing?
Pretty good. I just watched Jurickson Profar hit a home run.
I'm
more
good
news.
Exactly.
Super excited to hear that.
Not a good swing in the last 2 minutes. Well, let's go right there then. Let's go right to the AL wildcard race, which is for Indians fans the only topic that really matters right now. So one of the things I know a lot of fans, at least those who are more statistically inclined, like to do is wake up in the morning and look at various projections of which team's going to finish where, and maybe what you're most known for is Zips, the projection system you came up with. What does it look like for the Indians pending tonight's results?
Well, I had them at 70-something percentage odds for to get one of the wild cards coming into the game tonight. So long as the Twins don't complete this comeback that's going on, it'll probably go a little bit higher because status quo and everything, and it's better to have the
right
one game lead on the Rangers than, you know, not having it.
Right. It's been pretty, I mean, you know, we'll see what happens tonight, but the Indians have won six in a row, which is the best you could hope for in the last week, and Tampa's matched them. I guess Tampa's now won seven in a row because they won tonight, and the Rangers, after, you know, a pretty miserable stretch a week ago, they've won, I think, if they win tonight, four in a row. It's pretty impressive to have, you know, there's some complaints that the second wild card was letting a weaker teams in contention, but they're all playing really strong baseball here now.
The thing is, I would prefer not to have a wild card team, but if you have a wild card team, I like to have two more than one, because then at least you're giving a significant disadvantage to a team that makes in the wild card, because the wild card versus winning a division, I mean, the odds are half essentially.
Sure. Yeah, that's kind of how I feel, too. I mean, I've had plenty of time to get used to the wild card, and it's been around for the majority of the time I've been a baseball fan. But, yeah, I initially was sort of on the fence about the second one, but for the same reason I think I like it. I've said a couple times with different guests in the podcast, I don't think there's enough recognition given for regular season success. I think American sports you know, we love playoffs, and I understand why we love playoffs. But, you know, the team that's fantastic over the six-month season tends to get immediately forgotten if they don't also win the postseason championship. So I think I'm with you on that. I think a division winner getting an advantage is a good thing.
I mean, I would put them all in one big division, but I don't think – I think the train on that has moved on past the station. It's not going to happen
right.
ever again.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've seen, you know, some people who want, you know, add a couple more teams and go to eight team divisions in each league or something like that. But with 30 teams, I think this is going to be what it's going to be for a while. Well,
yeah,
give us a little background.
Like
how and when. Say that again.
I don't like the people that want, you know, everybody in one division take the top eight or something. I really, really hate that idea because you pretty much eliminate any meaningful contest between two excellent teams.
Right. Can you give us a little background on yourself? You know, tell me how and when you first became a baseball fan.
Well, I'm from Baltimore, and I love baseball as a child, and I love numbers too. And eventually it became kind of unlikely that I was going to grow up to become a baseball player. So I like to argue baseball and write about baseball. And when I was a kid, I loved reading early Bill James and Peter Gammons. They were the two guys I most followed first as an avid baseball fan. And I've just always loved it. In the 90s, I got involved in the early days of the internet, there was a forum called Usenet. I don't know how familiar you are with Usenet. And that's kind of where a lot of the sabermetric guys you see around today, a lot of them got their start there. Keith Carl, Christina Carl, Sean Foreman, Boris McCracken. And so that's how I got into it.
So then as an Orioles fan, to sidetrack you and bring it back to this season, what's the last week been like for that part of your baseball fandom?
Oh, this week has kind of stunk as they lost every game that they could until after they were eliminated. But it's still not as heart-wrenching as 1989 was when they blew that lead to Toronto in August and then went into that final weekend. The races that they lose when you're a kid will always kill you more than as an adult.
Fair. Yeah, I mean, for me, I was a teenager when the Indians lost their two World Series and didn't take either of them particularly well. I would like to think I would take it better, and I guess I hope I get the chance to find – well, I guess I don't want to find out what happens if they lose, but the Orioles – let's go back to 2012, because I think for me, you know, the Indians this year, I think they're overperforming expectations, but I think – you know, most people and projections and things like that saw them as about a 500 team, maybe a little better than that. And so to win 90 games is, you know, sort of the upper end of what you might have reasonably expected, but not wildly out. Whereas I feel like last year's Orioles were, in terms of wins and losses, a huge surprise and overperformer. Was that, for you, is it a huge surprise or?
It's not the most gigantic surprise. The Orioles last year were a bigger surprise, and I was kind of always in that awkward position where I have to kind of have that, you know, that professional detachment where I'm cynical and suspicious of wild improvements and stuff. But I did have Cleveland around 500, but with a chance. I did list them on my my team prop bets piece I did this March. I did take the Indians for $100 at 30-1 to win the AL pennant, 66-1 to win the World Series. So I'm not going to personally be all that upset if the Indians win the World Series.
Well, so does that mean with the Orioles out, we can count on your support the rest of the way?
Yeah, you can't beat a vested financial interest. It's not an alarming overpay. They always had that potential. They just needed some things to work out, and more of those things have worked out than not.
Right.
They got Jimenez, an actual good season from him.
Yeah, I mean,
they actually got 150 innings from Kazmir. I mean, what are the odds of that happening?
Yeah.
So,
the pitching, the 2012 Indians were one of the worst starting rotations, legitimately, in baseball history. You know, I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but I remember writing about it after the season ended, and it was just brutal. You couldn't have convinced me the numbers they've gotten from the guys you just mentioned. You know, Salazar's come up and pitched really well. Maybe the biggest surprise I can remember as an Indians fan is the performance of the rotation this year. And
I mean, it's not an amazing rotation, but it's good enough to get the job done.
Exactly. It's a decent rotation, and the jump between where they were last year and decent is massive. And really, since the All-Star break, they have been a very good rotation. I think Ubaldo Jimenez has been maybe the best pitcher in the American League, depending on which metrics you prefer, which no one in Cleveland – well, I won't say no one. We've got one loyal reader who is adamant that Ubaldo was going to turn it back around and was routinely ridiculed for it, and he gets to gloat now. But, the pitching's really carried them. The offense has struggled in the second half for most of the time until this last week. It's really been the pitching. Without getting into specific numbers, because I don't want to get us too bogged down in that, but are there and I don't know that you know individual players' projections off the top of your head or anything, but are there Indians who you mentioned, Jimenez and Kazmir, anyone else who's been a big surprise for better or for worse compared to where you and Zips saw them?
Well, some of the surprise has been in almost attendance. They've gotten a full season from Kazmir. Jimenez,
right.
I've been amply aware of his ERA all season because I took a bet for the over on ERA for him. So I've been watching it go down and down and down, and the money come out of my wallet. So I've been very aware of that fact. But really, they stopped the bleeding. It's not a rotation that you go into every game and thinking you're gonna get some sort of four inning, six runs allowed start and then have another loss.
Right.
And just reaching that level of just respectability has been enough to get the Indians into the race.
Yeah. And they did for anyone who's for somehow listening to this, not knowing what happened, the Indians did manage to hold on and win. So they're still a game back of Tampa and a game up on Texas. And Dan, as you said, so that'll make Tampa and Cleveland's, you know, figures then go up, right? Because the status quo is good if you're holding.
Any tie favors them, essentially.
Right.
And this is kind of – I got a lot of negative email and from Royals fans a couple weeks ago because I was trying to explain why the Royals' odds were so long. And one of the reasons was, as long as Cleveland was within earshot of the wild card, the very favorable schedule really had a lot of play for them. If you could knock Cleveland out, you had a problem.
Right. Well, okay. As someone who I think you must know baseball numbers pretty well, and as an Orioles fan. There's been a lot of talk this week about the schedule. And I know as an Indians fan, I felt sort of defensive about the Indians schedule. In part, I think because people are looking at who they're playing this month and sort of talking as if their schedule's been that easy all year when, they obviously had to play good teams. They just happened to have them all padded early in the season. But that said, the AL East is the best division in the American League. And so that does mean teams like the Orioles are playing more games against better teams over the course of the season. Do you think that's a problem, or what size problem do you think that is for fairness in baseball?
When you have a wild card involved, I don't see the argument for an unbalanced schedule. If it was just the divisions, I would like a more balanced schedule. I would like to, just as a fan, I like to see more more variety of matchups.
I do too. Do you think the main? I mean, I think the attendance figures would tell us that the average fan doesn't. The average fan, likes seeing the Yankees come to town, like seeing the Red Sox come to town. I'm intrigued for teams like Baltimore and Tampa Bay. If you could get ownership to be really honest, what they'd tell you they prefer in terms of are the extra ticket sales enough to justify the dent they maybe put in your record?
Say
that again.
And if it's them are completely different things. So I just know what I like. And if it happens to coincide with profitability, then so be it.
Yeah. Well, I think in terms of fairness, I think it's almost inarguable that a balanced schedule would be the most fair thing. But I also feel now, especially with the two wild cards now, that while it's not as fair because you're competing against teams, you've also still got a pretty reasonable shot, or a more reasonable than you used to, of still finding your way in. And I think I just feel like on the list of inequities in baseball, the unbalanced schedule is significantly lower than, revenue discrepancies and things like that. To me, Tampa Bay's in a tougher position because of money than they are because of the schedule. But again, I'm an Indians fan, and I'm sure I'm somewhat biased at the moment, and am happy that the Indians have the schedule they have and the finish they have. But they did have to get through. I mean, they late May, early June, I think they played 28 straight games against winning teams. And, Ken Rosenthal had a column this week and a couple other people talking about it, and as if they've just been playing the Astros and White Sox and Twins all season.
Yeah, but I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. But if you look at the strength of schedule, I mean, the Orioles' average opponent was like a 5-10 team, and the Indians, I think, was a 4-9, 490 team or something. It's not as big a discrepancy. And there's kind of a mitigating factor that if you're in a stronger division, you probably have stronger, more popular teams that bring in more revenue when they're in your stands in your park. Orioles may not like having to compete with the Red Sox, but I think the Red Sox coming to town bringing a lot more revenue for the team than the Twins coming to town. So there's a mitigating factor there. It's not that big a deal at all.
Yeah, I think that's how I feel. And I think, they're talking about, the Yankees have a tougher schedule. That was the initial comparison that I know set a lot of Indians fans off was, the Indians have a much easier schedule than the Yankees. And it's like, that's a non-starter. I refuse to listen to anyone complain about the poor plight of the Yankees.
Well, if the Royals were a worse team this year, there might be more of a case then. But that means they have to play a lot of games against the Tigers and the Royals and their respectability.
Yeah, and, it's only four games, but they're interleague rival, the Indians rival is the Reds. So that was a good team they were playing four times. It's not like they were, but again, I mean, it's only four games. I don't think any of it makes a massive difference. I just don't think it's worth the complaining that it's gotten from some people this week. I want to come back to Zips at this point late in the season. I think even fans who don't understand, probability and things like that can grasp pretty well why the Indians would be in pretty good shape. But what all factors go into specifically like the playoff chances, the projected standings in terms of strength of schedule or remaining opponents, or can you kind of, give us an explanation of what factors go into it?
Sure. Zips does a lot of player projections. And when you have a lot of player projections and a wide distribution of likely results, you have a pretty good idea of the range of quality of every team. You also know what the actual schedule is. And when you get to the last few weeks of the season, you know who the starting pitchers are. So that adds a thing. I use what's called a Monte Carlo simulation. It's a series of algorithms. To put it to a layman's term, it's just really a way to test a whole bunch of probabilities without having to do a whole lot of work with it. If you didn't know that a coin flip was 50%, a very simple Monte Carlo simulation would just be running it a million times. And it's the same thing when you have a lot of probabilities, just throw them all essentially in the bucket, see what comes out when you randomize things, and then you can get estimated odds from that.
So the team wins and losses are an eventual output of player projection inputs.
Yeah, remember, teams are really just a combination of the players. So if you have all the players and their expected on-base percentage and the slugging percentage and ERA, you can pretty much guess what the team's strength is. You can say that the Indians are maybe a 550 team, maybe a 530 team, maybe a 570 team. And you have essentially a series of probabilities, kind of a distribution, like a little pretty bell curve, not quite that neat, but the same kind of concept. And if you have a team that you think is a 540 team and they're playing a 520 team, you can pretty much guess with the odds ratio, that's another little statistical tool, what the expected odds of that game would be. And it's really just sending it over a million times every game and getting just estimated odds. And you can never get – you never know what the true answer is. They never play the real season a million times. So you never know if you were right because you were smart or if you're right because you got lucky. You never – one of those things you just have to live with.
Right. And do the player inputs, are they constantly changing because of a player's production, or is it sort of, I don't know, before the season you have player projections and then you update that? I mean, how often do the player projections change based on results? In other words, I mean, certainly Scott Kazmir and Corey Kluber and Ubaldo Jimenez, they're still not being projected based on what they were being projected for in March, I wouldn't think.
No, player projections are updated daily. It's funny, I actually use Fangraphs to get my player projections since they have it all set up neatly for me. but it's funny that way how it works out. Like, I gotta look up to see what my projections are. But more seriously, every game is new information. A projection is really kind of like a point in time, an estimate of about the midpoint of what we can expect from a player. But we don't really know these things. So every at-bat, every inning is new information that adds to our understanding and our expectations going forward. So player projections are kind of living and breathing. They always move. If you ever watch when there's like a hurricane in the Caribbean coming towards the United States, you see the little picture of the hurricane and that giant cone of uncertainty where they don't know where the tracks are going to go. That's what projecting a player is like. They're always moving. That little cone of uncertainty is always shifting. It might hit New York. It might curve out to sea. And so you always got to update. And I think that doing in-season projections was one of my better notions.
So what's your workload with Zips? I mean, like how much of it is you going in and changing stuff, you know, semi-regularly versus I have no idea what the computer systems behind it would be in terms of how much of it's sort of automated to some extent.
Well, I mean, a lot of the heavy lifting is automated. And of course the daily projections are completely automated with the exception of minor leaguers that Fangraphs doesn't have a mechanism right now for minor league translations. The in-season stuff isn't a lot of work. Actually, even in the off season, the majority of my actual work for the projections is putting together the disc that I do with Diamond Mind every year because I have to rate all the players offensively, and that actually is probably the hardest part.
Right. So when the projections, I would think the player projections are the ones, you know, a lot of people use them to, you know, for fantasy baseball drafts and things like that. I would tend to think those are the ones you get the most, for better or for worse, feedback on. Do you tend to take a lot of grief when a fan base feels aggrieved by how can you have
I get so much hate mail. It's very entertaining. I sometimes post them on Twitter. I'm at the stage now. I mean, I've been doing this for quite a while. Somehow I've become one of the elder statesmen of sabermetrics when I'm not really that old. I mean, I'm 35. But you get used to it. People always have a complaint. And when you project 2,000 players a year, a lot of them are going to be wrong. And you have to go in accepting the fact that a lot of them should be wrong. Because there's so much uncertainty around players that there's a limit to how often you can be right. For example, if you knew for a fact that every team going into a season was a 500 team, for a fact, you would never know that, of course, but assume that,
right.
that that's an absolute fact, you would still miss by 8 games with 20% of the teams. That's just math demands that you be wrong a lot. So if you don't like being wrong and can't deal with it, you want to probably stay out of predicting the future because you're going to be wrong a lot. Yeah, look at PR. Read my stuff. I'm wrong a lot.
Well, I think honesty is the best. Well, I think all of this, it's the kind of thing I think fans continue to become more and more educated. I think there's more outlets putting out good information and explaining things. I think for some of us, it feels like it's the progress towards that kind of understanding is too slow in terms of fans accepting it. But I don't know. I feel like most fans who care to look at projections at this point, I would think, understand all that. But I guess from the hate mail you get, that's pretty good evidence that a lot of them don't.
Trust me, you're very overconfident of the average person who notices the projections and gets angry and is going to let Darren Zaborski know how angry he is. I don't know what you think the reaction is going to be like. I'm going to get that email. I'm going to like start crying or something. I'm going to say, I'm never going to wait again. I'm sad. You called me a name. That's not going to happen. But it is a lot better today. I don't want to go kind of on a you kids today rant, but you go back 15 years, we had to argue with people who thought that Joe Carter was going to be in the Hall of Fame easily.
Right.
I once had an argument with a guy who thought Mookie Wilson was a Hall of Famer and Dave Winfield was not. and that was the kind of stupidity you had to deal with in the early days of the internet. There's actually been some forward progress. You can mostly get people to buy on base percentage and slugging percentage. You may not get all of them to buy wins above replacement, but you've actually probably sold most of the crowd on the basic structure of what makes up WAR and similar
right.
stats. You're not going to reach like Murray Chass or anything, but most writers I found are pretty open-minded and fairly supportive.
Well, and I think I think a big part of the progress is it's certainly not strictly generational. I mean, there are very open-minded and aware, older writers or media members, and there are young ones who don't grasp any of this and don't buy into any of it. But I think the younger you are, the more likely you are to sort of understand some of this stuff, or even if you don't totally understand it, you at least buy into it and believe in its legitimacy. And I feel like as, time passes, those groups begin to fill more and more of the prominent media spots. I mean, it would be nice if teams, TV broadcasters, and some of them do, Len Casper, the Cubs guy, is someone I know, he does a great job of trying to kind of, spread awareness, not just awareness, but to try to explain things in a way that the average fan can understand. Which I think is great, but you do still have a lot of guys who, sabermetrics is a joke.
But there really aren't as many as you might think. There's kind of a subset of kind of legacy columnists, but most are very good. I haven't had any kinds of negative experiences with writers, generally speaking. Part of it is generational, and that's kind of natural because, every generation is going to have their new ideas, and that's kind of the natural way it works. I'm sure if I'm still around and writing in 40 years, I'm going to sound old and crazy. Like, what can't kids today use WAR? You and your fancy biometric stuff. If Chelsea Clinton was president, none of this would happen. that's kind of to be expected. I've always had this theory that once you get a certain age, you kind of hit this kind of crossing the Rubicon where new stuff is difficult. Like my grandfather, he could understand a CD, but he couldn't understand a DVD. And to me, that's just like, what? The same thing. He understood that sound could be on a disc, but not sound and video. But it's just the way the world works. I mean, if Everything stayed the same.
Nothing to do
like
with anything, but you bring
whatever.
Up the CD. I'm a teacher, a grade school teacher, and somehow records came up, like audio records, vinyl records came up last week. And I realized that for all the advanced technology, whatever a vinyl record is doing when you're hearing music from it, to me is far more mind-blowing than whatever a CD is doing. Somehow, you know, the digital stuff, it's like, oh yeah, you know, computers are reading it. But then I'm trying to figure out how a record is working, and the vinyl record is the technology that totally blows my mind.
Yeah, we always had an old turntable, but I never quite understood it. If you're a teacher, though, I was a terror to grade school teachers. So you're lucky that you didn't have me as a student. I was always a difficult child.
Oh, I've got
seriously,
some terrors,
because my
I don't
parents,
know, it's
the way
grade school,
I was
school, for the they're young enough, it's pretty easy to forgive anything.
The way I was raised, I was kind of treated like an adult as a child, and I was never, like, you know, lied to about, like, you know, Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy. And I was the kid that would – all the kids that were about 5 or 6 in my elementary school, they would learn that Santa Claus didn't exist or the Tooth Fairy didn't exist from me. Which, of course, teachers and parents were very pleased about. They also learned all sorts of things from me, how babies were made – what happens to your body after you die, all these things I taught. So you're very lucky that you didn't have me as a student.
As an adult looking back, do you think they learned an accurate version of how babies are made? Or
was
it some sort of
it was very accurate. I knew exactly.
I don't want to get too blue here, but my understanding of how babies were made when I was in about 5th grade was close, but in a couple of key ways, wildly inaccurate.
I mean, we didn't talk about DNA or anything like that. But I did make children cry.
Well, speaking of people crying, going all the way back to the Orioles, you know, you mentioned this season not being as heartbreaking as a couple other ones. I would think, as a non-Orioles fan, the hardest part of the season is maybe seeing Dylan Bundy and Manny Machado both go down with season-ending injuries. Where does that put your mind at?
Oh, they were absolutely rough watching both of them, especially Bundy. I mean, when you knew Machado was going to be okay, it was a relief. But as depressing as they are, it doesn't just have that emotional impact it does when you're a kid. Writing about baseball is my job, so I
right.
do have this – you know, I just have this habit, because when you're doing something you love also for your job, there also, as I said, there becomes some kind of detachment to some extent. You're just, I don't know if it's the same for other people, but I'm just not as emotionally involved as I would have been 20 years ago. Obviously, I love
baseball.
How much baseball.
Of that do you
have,
think? How much of that do you think is age versus maybe some sense of professional responsibility? Or I don't know what other factors might be in play.
I don't know.
Do you
I
think
don't
if you were
to be that responsible.
If you were a teacher, you know, whatever, if you didn't get paid to cover baseball, do you think you'd still be less emotionally involved?
I'm not sure. I need to simulate it about a million times and compare. I live baseball. I mean, I have three large TVs here in my office. I always have games on all these screens. But I don't know. Just for me, when I write about it, it doesn't have the same, you know, living every moment with your team and dying with them. It's just
right.
It's just not that way for me. So this season isn't as devastating as 1989 was. I mean,
was it
88
when the Orioles started 0-20?
Oh, the 0-21 season, that was terrible. But they were really. But you see, the thing about that team is they were really good at being bad. If you're going to be bad, you want to be spectacularly bad.
Yep.
Because
everyone
remembers the 1962 Mets. No one remembers the other Mets teams that decade that just stunk. It's because there's something magical about it. Horrible season. I was talking about this on Twitter. Take the Astros and the Twins. The Astros this year are a much worse team than the Twins. But the Twins are just so blandly bad. Houston, I mean, you would be surprised if they lose 12 in a row or something. But Minnesota, I mean, the rotation is just full of pitchers that strike out four batters a game, and they accidentally win snoozer games against the White Sox that nobody wants to see. the Twins are just blandly bad. So that Orioles team wasn't as bad as some of the later bad Orioles teams.
Right.
Like, say, the 91 Orioles in those couple seasons after the 89 team where they kind of dropped back. Those were worse than the 88 Orioles from a psychological standpoint.
So with the detached is, you know, the Orioles out of it and, you know, it's your job and all of that. Do you have particular rooting interests remaining at this point, or are you just in sort of the hoping for the best baseball you can get no matter, you know, and you don't really care which teams it comes from?
Oh, well, I love any game that's played. I'm probably pulling for the Pirates the most, personally. I tend to have some kind of Pittsburgh loving, because when I was a little kid and the Baltimore Colts left to Indianapolis, since my dad's family was from the Pittsburgh area, I became a Steelers fan, which has, of course, created kind of this oddball circumstance in which I'm an Orioles fan and a Steelers fan. So I do tend to pull for Pittsburgh when Baltimore's no longer in the mix for baseball.
Well, and I think, I mean, the Steelers wouldn't fall into this category, but the Pirates, I think, at this point are a pretty easy team to get behind, just given what's gone on there for the last 20 years. I have to imagine a lot of people are going to get behind the Pirates once their team's out of it.
It's a weird September. How many times do you think you've heard anybody in Pittsburgh say, "Don't worry about the Steelers. We still have the Pirates." Because you have
just
to get the Steelers.
Like it's always been.
It's like you've gone down the wrong timeline. Like, what has happened? Why is Chris Gomez why is Carlos Gomez an MVP candidate? For some reason, I think Chris Gomez was the Detroit Tigers middle infielder that's been retired for 15 years. Why is he an MVP candidate? Why is Josh Donaldson one of the best players in baseball? It's kind of like you've gone down the wrong timeline.
Right.
Like a bad episode of Star Trek.
You're going to lose me. Okay. I'm a huge Star Wars fan, but I'm way out of my depth in Star Trek.
Well, then I can't make the jokes then.
You can make it. I'll politely nod, and some of my listeners, I'm sure, will appreciate it.
I can't see you politely nodding. I just hear uncomfortable smiles. And anything that kills radio or podcast is that awkward silence.
True. And I'm fairly new to the podcasting game. I started this 3 months ago or so, and I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm doing fairly well at it, but there are certainly moments in certain weeks when I feel like, oh God, this is getting away from me. I gotta figure out where I'm going here.
Yeah, in media, the awkward silence is always bad. It's not like a date movie where an awkward silence ends up in a kiss or awkward silence is always bad. Although it can be fun. If you ever go to a restaurant and you ask for a Coke and they say if Pepsi's okay, just say no and say nothing. It is the most awkward silence after that.
When I was in grad school, I worked in a restaurant and I had a couple of people tell me no. We had Coke and someone said, "I want a Pepsi." I'm like, "Oh, you know, is Coke all right?" And no, it's not. I want. There are people out there. Maybe they were all messing with me, but I'm pretty sure they were serious.
Now you see, that doesn't create that same sense of awkwardness. You just say no and then nothing. Just let the waiter stand there. I do tip well because I'm deranged and I do these things. But moving on.
Well, I can tell you, if you tip well, a lot can be forgiven because ultimately the tip is about 90% of what the server cares about. So if you're obnoxious but tip 25%, that's better than being an angel and tipping 15%. Your server doesn't care about your good manners. They care about your money.
Well, see, I
that advice, listeners.
Tip well.
Yeah. Tipping, I was in Iowa last weekend to see some extended family. I think, again, part of it's generational. I think part of it, I do think tipping's a little different in more rural areas. I think they're a little, the curve on the increase in tipping over the years is a bit slower there. And I find myself sort of like, I don't know, I get like almost like nervous when I see one of my older extended family members like picking up the check, because I'm like, oh my God, they're going to tip like 14% or something like that. And I'm going to feel terrible about it. But I also feel like I can't like grab the book and be like, oh, I'm going to put an extra $10 in here and horribly offend my uncle or something like that. I'm damned if I do and damned if I don't. Well, Dan, thank you for joining me. I would love to have you back on the show in maybe March once the projections for next year are out, so I can yell at you for how horribly you're underselling Jan Gomes and Jason Kipnis.
Well, see, here's the thing. One of the nice things about having projections expressed as a range of probabilities is that you always have plausible deniability when when something goes wrong. You can say, what did he hit 30? You projected him to hit 15. And you say, well, I did say there was a 3% chance. And things that happen 3% of the time do happen.
I think
3% of the time.
You should just let people believe that Zips is like a computer from an 80s movie. The computer who wore tennis shoes or something like that?
I kind of like the liaison. I say, like, I don't have any control over this. It was in my house when I moved here. I don't know. It was a mysterious old man who lived in a bookshop gave it to me. and then me and Southport were flying through the air, and then they just trust the projections. Don't blame me. I just live here. I'm just typing stuff in.
All right. Thanks a lot for joining me. I will have you back in a few months, and I'll catch up with you on Twitter in the meantime. Thanks a lot, Dan.
Okay. Oh, and I'm D. Zimborski on Twitter. But
your handle will be prominently displayed in the post tomorrow. I will tell everyone you are well worth a follow.
Okay. Well, if my Twitter name is not there, you have made a very powerless enemy.
That's my favorite kind.
You all have a good night.
Thank you. Okay, again, that was Dan Zimborski, a writer for ESPN and the creator of the Zips projection system, which I don't know where it's at tonight, but I would guess the Indians are at something like 85, 88%. And I'm a glasses half empty, nervous, pessimistic fan, so I find a hard time believing it, but the numbers can't lie. It's a cold, heartless computer. It was in his house when he moved there. Anyway, the Indians did hold on and win, so they've now won 7 in a row, which hasn't done a bit of good in catching Tampa Bay, but it has kept them in front of Texas. Baltimore, New York, Kansas City, all of whom were still in it a few days ago, they're out. 3 games left. Tampa Bay's in Toronto this weekend. The Cleveland Indians, I don't know why I just referred to them as the Cleveland Indians. You know where they play. They're in Minnesota, as you know, and Texas is at home against the Angels. The Indians win 3, they're in no matter what. If they win 2, they might be looking at a play-in game. If they win 1, we're hoping the Angels win a lot. Oh, my God, I just got a 90-second warning from the nice British lady. I guess that means I should go, but we will talk next week. I'm hoping we'll be talking on Tuesday in preparation for the Indians' appearance in the American League wildcard game. Have a good one.
When you go on a long drive, the last thing you want is a problem that leads to an unexpected... delay to your journey. So do a few simple vehicle checks before setting off, including tires, oil, water, and fuel. Highways England.